Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
We're breaking from our weekly podcast to bring you highlights from WSJ Tech's DLive conference in Laguna Beach, California.
The future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
In the global semiconductor industry, consolidation has been constant. But security concerns and recent trade tensions could threaten future growth and innovation. This episode, Richard Clemmer of NXP Semiconductors and Renee James of Ampere speak with Wall Street Journal Chief News Editor Jason Anders about what's at stake.
So you all get to join an argument in progress that Renee and I have been having about whether chips are boring and whether they're specifically too boring to talk about. So I say they're not because I have 20 minutes to talk about chips here. But Renee, you spent 30 years of your life in the chip industry. You're president of Intel. You've started a chip startup. You say they are boring.
No, I don't think they're boring at all.
Oh.
Or I wouldn't have started my own semiconductor company, but other people do.
Other people. These people.
We're here to convince them they're not, so they all want to work in semi.
They take them for granted, right? That's more your point.
I think so.
How so?
But they're going to change your life, so you better be careful.
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale, everybody.
As we sit through the conference and we're talking about AI and we're talking about self-driving cars and we're talking about all of the innovations that so many of the awesome companies represented here are working on, they all require more powerful and or more specialized or, you know, semiconductors underneath them to power the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I think we don't talk a lot about that because it's just taken for granted that someone will just invent them and that will all just happen.
Right. You too. You'll do all the work.
That's what we do.
So, Rick, you probably would have appreciated a little more boredom in your life this year than you had. So for anyone who doesn't know, and I think everyone does know, earlier this year, Qualcomm's deal to buy NXP for about $44 billion fell apart.
It did. After
it faced some Chinese regulatory trouble, and this was against a broader backdrop of a U.S.-China trade spat. Unpack this deal a little bit from your perspective. When did you kind of first think, oh, no, we're in trouble here?
Well, you know, you have to go back in time. First off, it was a great deal. The combination of the two companies would have created the industry powerhouse because of the breadth of the technology. As we went through the process, you know, Europe was even a little more challenging than what we would have anticipated. And part of that comes down to kind of the licensing approach that Qualcomm has,
yep.
Where there's a lot of press that has been written relative to, you know, the government's actually taking that on. But then once we finally got the European approval, which was a little late earlier this year, you know, the assumption was that China would fall in line very quickly thereafter. Now, about that time was when President Trump decided that he wanted to impose tariffs relative to import goods. And so it became a significant issue. At the same time, you know, ZTE was kind of put on the death blow for a period of time. And so we went through that process. We felt like that once ZTE was approved, that it would have kind of been an approval in exchange, if you would, for the Qualcomm transaction to purchase NXP would have been approved. I think what we didn't envision was the power of some of the local Chinese companies and whispering in the ear of the Chinese regulators, because what they didn't want to do is see Qualcomm become even more powerful, have a broader portfolio. Yeah. And so I think that was an issue. We went through the process. Actually, in April, the government suggested to Qualcomm that they pull the application because the deadline was coming up. They suggested they pull it and refile, which would have given them another 6 months through October. China has an excuse because they had through October to approve it.
Yep.
But, you know, clearly with all of the back and forth, we would have anticipated that it would have been approved right after the ZTE.
Was there any back and forth on the U.S. side between you and the U.S. government during this?
There was. I mean, clearly Qualcomm was very actively involved with the U.S. government. I actually had an opportunity as part of the Dutch delegation, since we're a Dutch company, to meet with President Trump and Secretary Mnuchin. And we discussed it in the meeting, and Secretary Mnuchin called China that night and suggested that it would be really favorable if they could approve the transaction.
And they said, great.
Didn't have much impact, but they did try.
And was there any direct contact with the Chinese side?
Oh, yes. There was ongoing dialogue with the Chinese. You know, SAMR was clearly taking some guidance from above. And, you know, it was a little confusing, a little bit of a black box, but there was discussion.
But did it feel like a negotiation, or was your sense that this is headed one way and there's not much we could say to change the course of it?
You know, at different times, it charted different ways, I would say. You know, at some times we felt like there was a real common understanding, and we felt like it was going to get cleared and approved. And then ultimately it didn't.
So. Yeah. So, Renee, we were talking about this a little bit backstage. The backdrop to this, too, is part of the administration's bet here is that being tougher on China now leads to better deals for companies who want to do business in or with China down the road, even if there's a bit of collateral damage, which Rick can attest to. What do you think about that? Is that a smart approach?
Well, I think the IP protection line of thinking is it's a real issue. And I think we all appreciate that direction. I think the tariff situation to date, I understand it. I understand it as part of the position. But we also need to remember that China is the second largest consumption market for digital technologies and one of the largest importers of semiconductors in the world. And that's an import. So we need to be cognizant of that as we think about it as it relates to our part of the business. But the intellectual property issue is real, and I think protections are appropriate.
So clearly, China has made no secret of the fact that it very much wants to build a strong, homegrown semiconductor industry. Mm-hmm. They're pouring an unprecedented amount of money into this.
$100 billion being raised to $150 billion.
That's right, which I think if you look at the amount of money spent in investment in Silicon Valley, that would cover many, many decades of time. They're doing it in a compressed period of time. What do you make of this? And by the way, I go back a few years ago, not that many years ago, in fact, when folks said, well, okay, they'll do some manufacturing of cell phones, but they're going to be low-end, low-cost, commodity, kind of crummy cell phones. They won't be able to do the high-end. And they absolutely have done that there. And with chips, too, people are now saying, well, they might get a foothold on some of the lower-end commodity chips, but it won't be the more advanced processors. But they're, in fact, going for those.
They are, and I think as their industry matures, it's always going to be a challenge. I think, you know, for semiconductor industry, one of the things that I've always learned is you got to run faster than the competition, and clearly in this case, you got to run faster than China. I think that ultimately, with the massive amount of spending, there are some key kernels of technology, you know, that if we can protect that, will actually give us a basis. But, you know, semiconductor industry is a global industry, so it's really not country by country. But it is important to protect your intellectual property, and that is the biggest challenge in China.
I think you're right. I think you have to run fast. You have to build the best products. It's a very flat industry. You know, as many non-U.S. engineers work for me as U.S. engineers, it's the nature of the business. We operate globally. I mean, my new company is, you know, 1 year old semiconductor company, but we operate all over the world already. We're global. It's the nature of the business. So I am, you know, I understand protecting intellectual property. I spent my whole life building intellectual property at a very successful firm. But I also appreciate that, you know, it's a global business and protectionism probably isn't going to work. So we just need to be balanced about that.
Yeah.
The other thing is semiconductors, you know, the building and assembling of products, finished goods, a phone, is very different than the discovery of new materials to get to new lithographies and to have breakthroughs in performance and or, you know, the actual embedding of a new kind of security into transistors. That is a important, and this is where the intellectual property protection comes, the know-how is really the thing that you're protecting in this business.
Sure.
And that's the thing that United States, from a competitive perspective, has been a leader in and invented a lot of the know-how on the process side of how to even build transistors.
Do you think that, I mean, $150 billion is going to go a long way on this front?
Depends on how many fabs you build.
Okay. So, but do you think that on a level playing field, and let's assume for a moment it is, and it's probably not, but on a level playing field, can China, with that kind of backing and that kind of organization, build its own semiconductor industry that you think will go toe-to-toe with U.S. and Western and
I think
Dutch
the jury is out. I think, you know, for example, we've sold a couple of significant companies to Chinese investors. Mm-hmm. They're still operated outside of China. Decisions, there's no technology flowing back to China, but they want to own that. So, you know, they can take the credits associated with owning a semiconductor business. We sold a very large transistor and diode technology associated with it. But I think the jury's really out associated with it. I think it's all about innovation. As long as you can lead in innovation, and that's not U.S., Western, I think it's got to be driving innovation that will make a difference. I mean, there's a lot of people here who really don't understand the impact that semiconductors have. I mean, in a car today, 90% of the innovation that's coming from is no longer in the engine. It's no longer in the body.
Right.
It's in the electronics.
Right.
And so, you know, we see that becoming more and more across the board. And it's just going to continue to accelerate. So if we can continue to drive that innovation, then that'll protect us.
And you brought up the global nature of the chip business. And when we were talking before we came out here, you were telling me about how, you know, when you sell a product sometimes, you don't really know where it's going to end up. It's going to go through a really complicated supply chain. So talk a bit more about that.
Well, you know, for example, we have products that, you know, we will do wafer fab in the U.S., we'll assemble it in China, and we'll ship to a customer back in Europe. So, and when we ship product into a customer in China, one of the things on the tariffs, you don't know where that product's going to ultimately end up, because they may actually take the subassembly and ship it to Southeast Asia, to Europe, to the U.S. So we really can't track the actual usage of semiconductors per se.
There was a report earlier this year that got a lot of attention by a different news organization that alleged there was an effort by Chinese companies to insert tiny chips into hardware during the manufacturing process that could compromise servers and related equipment. And the alleged victims of this, including Apple and Amazon, they weren't compromised. But I want to ask you just more philosophically, do you think an attack like that, given what you both know about the global supply chain and just how difficult this stuff is to build, is an attack like that feasible?
Feasible? Maybe.
Not practical. Maybe.
Not practical.
Not practical.
Not practical.
How so?
The complexity in the manufacturing process for these products is, first of all, it's automated for the most part. Secondly, it's incredibly complex, but it's also pretty tightly controlled. This is not, you know, someone just walks out onto an assembly line. That is not how these products are made.
Yeah.
You know, they're made in places where they're incredibly secure facilities. It's very difficult to get into them. It's a complex process, and it just doesn't seem that practical to me.
Well, and you would have to re-architect the layout of the board.
There's that. There's the practicality of the fact that you can't just put a chip
right in.
The level of complexity is so high today that every piece is meant to go with each other. So they're timed. They have interconnect between them. They have, you know, very sophisticated mechanisms.
Sure.
And you just don't insert something. Notwithstanding the fact that the facilities in which they're made are secure facilities. I mean, I couldn't even walk out into an assembly line, even, you know, as the CEO or the president of Intel, whatever. There's security, there's a mechanism for knowing who's going in. It's just not that practical.
But again, though, you were talking about the complicated nature of the supply chain process and the way these things are built. You're often talking about a facility building a product with maybe dozens of companies' chips in it. So none of those CEOs might not be the person in charge. It might be, you know, a far-flung manufacturing plant somewhere that is putting the whole thing together.
But there's also multiple sources of that manufacturing. And so for it to be across the board, it would be very difficult to do. But it's, you know, it's not just that you can come in and do a custom fit on it. You know, the design is laid out. It's registered. There's not really an easy way to add a chip that wouldn't have been noted, I guess is the key.
Yeah,
and you couldn't connect it for sure.
No.
So I think you both come to this from slightly different perspectives. So this is interesting. I wonder.
Very complimentary.
Very complimentary perspective. Yeah. But Renee, I'll ask you first. Is this the core battleground for computing? Does whoever wins AI, do they win computing?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's the core battleground. I think it's the driving force. So the reason I like it so much is I build high performance, you know, processors, and AI in its various flavors, from machine learning to et cetera, drive, including onboard of self-driving cars and, you know, vision systems, require more and more and more compute power. So for me, it's like the unending, you know, driving force of why there's opportunity and growth in the space. But there's other challenges beyond AI. I mean, there are things on the horizon that I think are more monumental that we have people working on and that companies are working on around quantum computing.
Yep.
I think there's other things out there that are in addition to AI. There's three or four kind of key technologies that I think are the pillars of the race for, you know, what is going to be the control of the next wave, if you will.
And, you know, when you talk about artificial intelligence, machine learning, I think it really gets back to the disruption allowed by the cloud and, you know, in whatever form it is. And so whatever you can do to be able to facilitate that, we've seen, you know, what Amazon, AWS has done, Microsoft, Google, they're all fighting for how they can bring value through the cloud. And so I think one of the important elements is be sure that we have the ability to take information instead of just shipping it all to the cloud. We do some pre-processing, so we only send to the cloud what's important to make it more efficient so that you can then take those appropriate actions. Because I think it's like 98% of all the information that goes to the cloud is not ever utilized, not ever analyzed. So by doing that pre-processing, I think we're at the early stages of really making artificial intelligence and machine learning much more innovative and much more significant.
Sure. Okay, great. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Rick Clemmer of NXP and Renee James of Ampeer speaking with Wall Street Journal Chief News Editor Jason Anders. The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green and Laura Sim. Our technical director is Jacob Borski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Thanks to our editors on the live journalism team, Yoon-hee Kim, Nikki Waller, and Kim Last. And special thanks to festival organizers Anna Raftal, Andrea Acosta, and Robin Wood-Saylor. Be sure to check back for regular episodes in the weeks ahead, including special reporting on the Earth's changing climate. And remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in Laguna Beach, California.
This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.